as Greek debt talks continue.
What's at stake for the global economy?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, January 26th.
Coming up, the view from Davos, where the world's rich and powerful are gathered.
Reports of the demise of Netflix appear to have been exaggerated.
And Groupon is in trouble for selling snake oil. Seriously.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We'll start in Greece, where the talks continue between the government and its private lenders. They're trying to renegotiate how much debt Greece needs to repay. We're joined now by Adolfo Laurenti. He's deputy chief economist at Mesirow Financial, and he joins us from Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So, Adolfo, lay out the stakes for us. What might happen in Greece, and why does it matter to the rest of us?
Well, the alternatives are between a nice and clean default with a deal with the bondholders and the losses contained within the current creditors, or as an alternative, a messy default with the bondholders suffering a much larger losses, but then in turn they may trigger the payment for the insurance or their bond, the infamous credit default swaps, and then losses will reverberate through the financial system like a stone thrown into a pond. That's the real concern.
Well, and you're talking about credit default swaps. These are complicated things, but they are basically the reason that AIG collapsed back in the financial crisis in 2008. Are you saying that if there is a messy default in Greece, we could be looking at another AIG-like situation in Europe?
Exactly. Unfortunately, these credit default swaps lacking transparency, so they are traded over the counter, so nobody really keeps tab about who owes what to whom, and this can be very destructive to the confidence and trust within financial markets, as we learned in 2008.
Now, then, let me ask you about something that Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan Chase, said this morning on CNBC. He said that if there is a messy default in Greece, that U.S. banks will not be hurt at all.
Well, that seems to be a little bit too optimistic and also minimalist. Yes, it's true. We do not have much direct exposure to Greece, but we have a lot of exposure to the French and German and many other European banks,
right,
who are heavily exposed to Greece. So the chain and the risk is there, even if Greece in itself is not that big for the U.S. financial markets.
Adolfo Laurenti, deputy chief economist with Mesirow Financial, thanks so much.
Thank you. My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Now to France, where faulty European breast implants were made with industrial-grade silicone instead of medical-grade gel. The scandal has been unfolding over the last few weeks, and today the head of the French company that produced the implants was arrested. The worry? They could rupture and leak and make women sick. For more, we have the BBC's Hugh Schofield with us from Paris. Good morning.
Good morning, Adrienne.
So help our listeners understand what exactly is going on here. What's the scope of this problem?
Well, we know that this company, PIP, has been producing low-grade breast implants. That's without question. It went out of business, the company, a year or so ago. And what's happened since is that there have been a big health scare has grown up around it, with some women complaining of basic problems like leakage and irritation and so on, but a group of women worried that it could be even more serious, that it could be a link with cancer. And that's why this arrest has come, because there's a judicial case now launched against the company, against the man, Jean-Claude Mass, for personal injury. He's been placed under investigation on a suspicion of causing damage to the bodies of women.
Now, I understand there's some question about who will pay for the removal of a lot of these implants. Is that right?
Well, that's sort of separately what's happening. That's sort of the non-judicial aspect of this, is, you know, how to clear up what's happened. And there are differences in different countries. I mean, this is an international problem. Let's not forget. Here in France, the government has stepped in and said that the 30,000 or so women who've had the implants can have them removed at the expense of the taxpayer, basically. They're saying that there's nothing urgent, there's no proof of a link with cancer, but it's clear that they are substandard, therefore the government is stepping in to pay for that. In other countries, for example, like in Britain, they're saying, yes, we agree these implants are substandard, but there is no sign of any significant or serious health risk beyond irritation, so consult your doctor if they say you need it, then go ahead. But certainly we, the government, are not going to pay for it.
The BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris. Thanks.
Thank you.
If you're looking for the world's bankers, CEOs, and economists this morning, you'll find them in Davos, Switzerland. They're gathered there for the World Economic Forum, which is basically a giant brainstorming session for people with enough money to do big things. Tom Keane of Bloomberg TV is there covering the forum, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, you've been talking with some of the big players over there at Davos. What have they been saying about the economy this year?
Without question, yesterday's theme, the first day of this session, was about austerity in Europe and the mystery of how to combine austerity with economic growth. There's no other topic, Jeremy. I'll be honest, I don't hear many constructive answers.
And you're talking about austerity versus growth in Europe. Are the people from the United States who are at Davos paying close attention to that?
They're paying very close attention to it, particularly the bankers that are here. But I would say, and it's a very good point you make, there is a disassociation this year of the challenges of the United States from Europe. There's a very good feeling here that, for the most part, the United States has got it right.
All right, let me ask you this now. Does Davos really matter, or is it just an excuse for the rich and the powerful to get together and have some hot chocolate in the snowy mountains?
The chocolate's very good. In record snowfall, I can say that. The answer is both stereotypes are accurate. It is a playground. It is the 1%. But with that said, the biggest change in 3 years is the CEOs that come here, they go 15 hours a day. Jeremy, they're not into touchy-feely panels on, green this in Antarctica. They're meeting their customers and their competitors. That's what they do when they're here. That changed about 3 years ago.
Tom Keane, host of Surveillance Midday on Bloomberg TV, joining us from Davos, Switzerland. Tom Keane, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Netflix shares were up 25% at the opening bell this morning on Wall Street after the company gave us this number yesterday, $41 million in profit for the last quarter. Now, that's not what investors were paying attention to, though. They were paying attention to the fact that subscribers appear to be coming back to Netflix after fleeing last year over a price increase. And as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports, the new customers are doing just what Netflix wants them to do. They're signing up to stream video online.
Last year, Netflix hiked its prices by as much as 60% and moved to split off its famous DVD by mail service from streaming video. Subscribers were not happy. 800,000 people cut ties with Netflix, but now nearly all have returned.
People forget, they don't like it. There's a protest. They use their feet and walk away, but then they move on.
Ken Doctor is a media analyst with the consulting firm Outsell. He says Netflix got ahead of its customers, but now its subscribers have caught back up. They're starting to choose streaming over old-fashioned DVDs. But he says that success presents Netflix with a new problem. It's known for all those DVDs you can get in the mail. Its streaming library isn't nearly as deep.
The next customer dissatisfaction to look at is, are there enough movies to keep me paying a subscription price to Netflix for streaming?
Plus, Netflix isn't the only company to realize the potential of streaming. It's already facing competition from Hulu, and Netflix says Amazon is planning to compete directly with them. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Netflix also announced yesterday it's backing away from plans to rent video games. Sorry, all you gamers out there. And that wasn't the only video game news making headlines, so we figured we'd call Jeff Ryan for a little video game roundup. He's the author of Super Mario: How Nintendo Conquered America. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning.
So Netflix is ditching its plans to rent video games. What does that tell us about the video game industry?
Well, Gamefly was a competitor to Netflix that was renting video games. Video games are a lot more expensive, and I think Netflix is basically trying to stay with their core businesses, which is, movies.
So now to Nintendo, which announced its first ever annual loss in 2011. What do you make of that?
Well, some of it is they have a problem with online content, that you can't really play online Nintendo games the way you can with their competitors. Another thing is Apple. Apple is really eating their lunch with smartphones. If you're carrying a smartphone, you're carrying a mobile gaming device, even if you don't use it as such. Nintendo sells hardware and software, and they don't. You don't need to buy any hardware to play a $1 version of Angry Birds.
Now, one more piece of video game news today. There are rumors that Xbox's next system won't be able to play used video games. What's that tell us about the industry?
That a lot has to do with GameStop. Because you can buy video games online now and stream them directly, GameStop has nothing more to do than to sell used video games. So this is their way of saying, no, not even used video games will fly nowadays.
Jeff Ryan is the author of Super Mario, How Nintendo Conquered America. Thanks.
No problem.
Now to the Republican presidential primary race. Tonight we have our first debate since Mitt Romney released his tax returns, in which he told us he made $21.7 million in 2010. Much of that from investments he made at the private equity firm Bain Capital, even though he retired from there more than a decade ago. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
The number that pops out here is $12.6 million. That's Romney's 2010 capital gains income. It comes from investments and is taxed at a lower rate than wages. Victor Fleischer teaches tax law at the University of Colorado. He says most of Romney's capital gains come from private equity investments he helped set up at Bain Capital more than a decade ago.
The manager at Bain Capital will help advise the investment fund when they purchase portfolio companies, whether it's Staples or Dunkin' Donuts. When the fund ultimately sells those underlying investments, the partners of Bain take a share of the profits.
The profit may exceed 20%, but it may not pan out for years until Staples or Dunkin' Donuts has been turned into a profit-making machine and sold off. There's another reason Romney's still making millions. He negotiated a sweet departure deal under which he gets a cut of the profits from investments that Bain made after he left. Nice work if you can get it in retirement. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Well, the number that really got people talking when Romney released his taxes was the amount of money he paid in taxes, which brings us to our weekly attitude check.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
We want to know how Americans feel about taxes, the taxes they pay and those paid by their BMW-driving neighbor. So we turn to Frank Newport, as we do every week. He's the editor-in-chief at the polling firm Gallup. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning.
So how do Americans feel about the taxes they pay?
Well, Americans, generally speaking, feel a lot better about the taxes they pay now than they did in the past. We've seen a clear indication that over the last decade, Americans have become less and less negative about taxes, and that's probably a result of the Bush tax cut. Americans still don't think that the amount of taxes they pay is necessarily too low, but we certainly don't have the angst about taxes that we had 10 or 15 years ago.
And how do we feel about the taxes wealthier folks pay?
Ah, that's a different question. That's one of the most verified and replicated findings we have in American survey research over the last year or two. Consistently, 60 to 70% of Americans, right in that range, say the upper income Americans, wealthy Americans, however you want to define it, need to pay more in taxes. In fact, we just asked Monday night, just before President Obama's State of the Union address, do you favor higher taxes on upper income Americans? 63% said yes. So that's our most recent iteration of the same thing. It doesn't matter how you ask it. Americans say, yeah, sure, tax the rich.
Now, do you have a sense people are paying more attention to tax rates now than maybe they were a year ago?
I don't think so. Every way we look at the data, what is the economic problem that bothered you most for your family? What's the biggest economic problem facing the country? What's the biggest problem in general facing the country? Nowhere do we see very many Americans at all talk about taxes. So I don't think that's a premier issue. What Americans are really concerned about economically now is jobs and having some kind of income that they can pay taxes on.
Frank Newport is editor-in-chief at Gallup. Thanks.
Good to be with you.
One final note now on the GOP race from Jacksonville, Florida, where the four candidates, as we said, will be debating each other tonight. But unlike in the last debate, the audience will be allowed to cheer and jeer the candidates this time. The debate audiences have taken on a new level of importance in the race this year. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports on how exactly the audience members are chosen.
Debate audiences are picked by the sponsor. The Florida Republican Party is the main sponsor of tonight's face-off. Florida GOP spokesman Brian Hughes says seats will go to rank-and-file members, and they can hoot and holler all they want.
You know, some of the energy that an audience filled with grassroots people can bring, we see that as part of the energy of the debate itself.
That energy exploded in a debate last week when Newt Gingrich attacked the media.
I am tired of the elite media protecting Barack Obama by attacking Republicans.
Paul Light teaches political science at New York University. He says wild applause can influence a debate's TV audience.
And you kind of forget what the candidate just said, and you just say, wow, these people love them, therefore I should love them.
CNN is moderating tonight. If things get rowdy, it says it'll ask the audience to refrain. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, school lunches are about to get healthier.
Oh, yeah. This is the yesterday Michelle Obama made a big announcement, right?
Yep. They're going to have less fat, more vegetables. It's the first new set of guidelines from the USDA in 15 years. But the lunches aren't going to be all kale and beets. The Christian Science Monitor reports that French fries still count as a vegetable. And so does pizza, Jeremy.
They still have pizza as a vegetable?
Pizza, I thought there was some controversy. It's the tomato sauce on pizza. I guess it counts as a vegetable. But they've added a rule that if you have a pizza vegetable on your plate, you have to have another vegetable there, too.
Uh-huh. This morning, the Conference Board gave us some data that can be used as an economic forecast. It's called the Leading Economic Index. But this time, the way the numbers were crunched was different. Marketplace's Economy 4.0 correspondent David Brancaccio has been looking at how the economy can better serve more people, and he joins us now from New York to discuss. Good morning, David.
Hi, Jeremy.
So first, tell us about the old-fashioned economic index that we've had up until now.
Its traditional grab bag was everything from building permits to different surveys of consumer confidence. And then there was this thing called, I hope you're sitting down, it was called the real money supply. Hmm. It's not all that complicated. It's money. It's coins, paper currency, stuff that you have by your bedside on the little table there over by your nightlight. It's also your savings accounts, your traveler's checks. Used to be, back in the day when I was a boy, that was a pretty good indicator of the economy because that's where a lot of our money was, but not so much anymore.
So now they're going to change this into a new leading economic index.
Yeah, and here's why.
The financial marketplace has become much more complex.
That's Annette Ozel-Dirham, who directs economic research for the Conference Board, the business research group that pulls together the leading economic index. It's more complex, he says, and we have all these wonderful different places to put our money, not just coins and savings accounts, right? They're credit cards. You can write those fakey little checks that draws money right from your home equity
right.
line if you want to. So the newfangled Model Year 2012 Leading Economic Index is going to have something called credit in it.
The new Leading Credit Index should give us a better picture of all the different types of credit activity and how that might impact and interact with the economic cycle.
So this credit index is embedded in the overall newfangled leading economic indicators. And Jeremy, it makes sense, right? If you want to get a sense of where the economy is going, why not ask a loan officer at a bank, you know, are you lending these days?
That's right. You've got to talk about the money that we're spending that we don't have, as well as the money we're spending that we do.
Beautifully put.
Marketplace's Economy 4.0 correspondent David Brancaccio. David, thanks.
You bet.
Mobile phone maker Nokia had a terrible end to 2011. The company says sales fell 21%. It lost more than $1 billion. And so far, the company's plan to turn things around by making phones with Microsoft hasn't dented iPhone's dominance in Europe. But Nokia says it still believes in the turnaround plan because it hopes a cheaper Windows phone may prove more popular here in the U.S. In today's Midday Extra, Christopher Wirth reports.
We all know this sound. Nokia used to be one of the most popular cell phones available, but in the smartphone age, its fortunes have lagged against the likes of Apple's iPhone. Today, the company's comeback depends on its new partnership with Microsoft. Last year, the pair-up launched its latest round of smartphones using Windows software onto the European market. So far, it's sold over 1 million of the new handsets in Europe. But Lee Simpson, a tech analyst at the investment bank Jefferies, says Nokia will have to compete in the U.S. and at a much better price than the iPhone.
If Nokia, or more importantly, Microsoft, can crack the US market, then we have a rejuvenated Nokia. If not, we possibly have Nokia stuck in the same basement sort of category that it's been in the last few years.
Nokia will reportedly launch a new smartphone in the US in March. The price tag, $99.99. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
And finally, to Groupon, which is being called a snake oil salesman in the UK, Adrian, and with good reason this time. The company advertised a deal last year for wrinkle killer snake serum. So they actually were selling snake oil. It claimed customers who rubbed the snake oil on their skin would look younger, but the authorities in the UK say that's unsubstantiated. There's no way to prove that. And Groupon should not sell snake oil anymore.
They probably could have figured that.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.